This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 20th of December 2015 on Monocle 24.
And welcome to a special festive edition of the Monocle Weekly, number 337, here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. On today's show, we'll be sorting Christmas dinner, possibly the contents of your stockings, ooh, our missus, and even enjoying a pre-dinner aperitif too. Robert, what's coming up?
We'll start with those aperitifs, I think, Andrew. Alex Kamerling, a sculptor-turned-drinks expert and founder of aperitif brand Cam & Sons, will be here to tell us why the build-up to the main event is just as important as laying on a cracker of a meal.
And if we're still standing after that, we'll take a break for a hike up to the Swiss Alps, where the Irish poet and novelist Padraig Rooney has been finding inspiration. His new book, The Gilded Chalet, Off-Piste in Literary Switzerland, looks at why writers from James Joyce to Ernest Hemingway have found solace in snowy mountain retreats.
And finally, we'll be serving the main course, a chat with Kaz Hildebrand, the designer whose touch across some of the biggest cookbooks this Christmas means they look as enticing on the covers as the recipes within.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be looking at possibly the slowest news week of the year while taking us through to 2016. And there'll be some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
It's Christmas next week, Andrew. Are you ready to rock?
I'm ready.
You're ticking things off your script with such gay abandon. I hope you're not trying to get through the show and just get straight to the cocktails.
That'd be a good kind of stage name, Gay Abandon, wouldn't it? I think I could take on that persona.
Oh, look at her.
I think especially after a couple of drinks from Alex Kamerling, I think I will be up
with
there.
With a rah-rah skirt made simply of crossed out scripts of the Monocle Weekly.
I think there were one or two people who came disguised as gay abandoned to our Christmas party this year as well.
There's always a bit of that, isn't there?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I never thought it from you.
Always putting one or two people in a taxi at the end of the night. But it was a very fun occasion anyway.
How's your bag this year, Andrew? Have you been speaking to your bag much this year? Do listeners want to hear about Andrew? Of course, Andrew. People
This is many years ago. I was once a little bit the worse for wear, and on my way home, I had to have a conversation with my bag, convincing ourselves that we could both get there.
It's going to be okay.
We're going to make it. Don't worry. We're going to make it.
Okay.
I was heard to say. Anyway, that is done for my reputation in like 2 minutes. I've got a new drag name, and I've been revealed as a lush. I think we
should get it in before 2016.
Yeah. I think we should bring in another person in the same category.
Who's that moving at the speed of light? Darting around the globe with his golden cape aflutter, waggling his chunky glasses, and giving us a knowing wink as he passes. His cuddly beauty silhouetted against the stars. Who could have such a wise yet pretty face? Or such a wiggly bottom? Could it be? Oh yes, it's Monocle's very own Clark Kent, our intrepid reporter and all-round lifesaver. And look, he's coming into land. Please welcome the one and only Super Tedwards, the news bear who likes his stories served with ice cream, please. We love you, Super Tedwards.
Well, maybe they should be served with brandy butter now. Next few days.
Exactly. A seasonal fare.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that you dipped your tail in glitter for today. That's a
Where's that sound effect?
It's quite a clever look.
Yeah. What is that sound effect at the end of that?
No one really
knows. Is it sort of a duck?
It could be.
It sounds like a duck.
It could be whatever you want it to be, and I think that's important at this time of year.
What is it? What do you think it is? What is it in your head?
I prefer not to speculate. The inside of my head, the dark recesses, Rob.
But you're quite mocking, but you have your own sound effect, don't you? Are you going to do the sound effect you do after most things?
No, I don't have a sound effect.
You do. What's the thing, the sound effect that you can't stop doing?
I don't do it. So I'm.
What, people claim that you do it all the time. What is
the sound?
Well,
people claim that I make this noise. Boo! And I don't do that.
What's that? Is it?
I don't do that. I just did it then to demonstrate.
He does it all the time. So if it's like a comic effect.
I challenge our listeners, find an example of me on M24.
Yeah.
Prior to today. Making that noise, and I shall provide a cash prize.
It's a comedy effect.
I want to
see,
find
he
it.
Loves it. He loves it. Anyway, so what's going to happen over the next few days? I know one or two things, but maybe you found some others.
What
Christmas Day is coming this way.
Exactly.
5 days away.
More on that in a moment or two.
And on the 24th, it's my birthday.
Are you a Christmas Eve-er?
I am.
Oh, God, I think I'm... Yeah.
That could be, that could be another kind of drag name, Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve and Gay Abandon. It's good. You need three.
We're going to do a show together.
So, Andrew, traditionally with gift giving, did you get a brace of gifts at once? Was it one thing then... A night to wait and then another set of gifts?
I was always...
Did people try and fob you off with a solo?
No, when I was young, it was very good. Fine. When you get to like 8 or 9, people say, oh, I bought you a double present this year.
Oh, that's a cop-out.
That's a cop-out, isn't it? And then when you get to like kind of your late teenage years, you're speaking to your parents on like Christmas Eve and you're like, they say, oh, we're looking forward to seeing you tomorrow. Anything else? No, I think we've got everything covered.
Oh.
What about happy birthday? Oh my God, I forgot.
No.
Andrew's memoir.
It's heartbreaking, sort of Dickensian Christmas tale.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Andrew's memoir is at least going to be called One Day Away from Being Christ. It's always good. Always nice and modest.
Yes.
Yeah. Excellent.
Anyway, let's move on because I might start crying.
No, so look, there's lots of Christmassy stuff around this week. There's a bit of business going on. Afoot right now in Spain, parliamentary elections. That's quite interesting.
Yeah.
But it's not Christmassy, so let's move on.
I know, I was hoping that Liam Alds would be forced to stay in Spain for the election results. He's disappearing. Doesn't give a damn.
Doesn't give a damn. He's in Bali.
Yeah.
What kind of commitment is that to political coverage?
And not the Bali Mo.
Exactly.
We've done that joke a few times already.
What else is seasonal? Well, there's a few kind of seasonal niceties that occur.
Yeah.
One that always strikes me as rather interesting. This is happening in Las Vegas, I think also today, and produced by... apparently, the potential next president of the United States, Miss Universe. It still happens. It's in Vegas. Donald Trump's still attached to it,
right,
even as he offends everyone in the planet, including our own sensibilities and fears, because he might... Well, he's still around in the race for the White House, somehow.
If he put on a big white beard, would you sit on his knee?
I wouldn't go near him with a 10-foot pole.
Boom!
See, that would have been... I imagine that's when you might have done it.
Okay.
Do the sound effect.
I'm not doing it again.
Just do it one more time. I wouldn't go near him with a 10-foot pole.
Boo.
Oh, very good. See, does it? It works in most situations.
This is Miss Universe. It's happening in Las Vegas today.
In Las Vegas. But let's draw a veil over that, because that's terrible. Draw a veil over that, because it's Trump. See, that's good.
Okay.
What else have we got? Tuesday the 22nd. Couple of seasonal favourites. I like... we're talking about Spain. People are quite bothered about the election, but they're more concerned with...
El Gordo.
El Gordo.
Yes.
Every year, absolutely mega. Liam's not... He didn't cash in from El Gordo. That's not where he's gone, is it?
I don't know.
That'd be a worry. And elsewhere, here in Blighty, druids are celebrating a solstice. That's on Tuesday as well, which is always great.
Love that.
A lot of beards and cloaks and... I don't really know what they get up to, but it's exciting.
Mm. Well, it's a second use for your old bed sheets as well. Don't throw them out.
Yeah.
I'm a druid.
They probably do.
Third use if you're Donald Trump, of course.
Oh, my God. What have we got on Wednesday? Rob, one I know you always enjoy. Noche de los Rabano.
Okay. What's a Rabano?
It's a radish. It's the radish. It's Oaxaca's premier radish carving festival. I think we've discussed it before. If you want a sculpture of an animal, a saint, conquerors and kings, carved into the humble radish.
So what day is that, Tom?
That's on Wednesday.
So that's how because that could be an ideal birthday a birthday gift for Andrew.
The best radish artist.
Oh, have a whip round. No, get a radish for him.
The best radish artist, they're starting today.
Yeah.
3 days of intense vegetable waste carving to make the best. Maybe they could do a portrait of Andrew Tuck.
Is that what you'd rather have for your birthday, whip round?
What have I walked into?
Christmas Eve loves that.
Well, speaking of Christmas Eve, of course, there's all sorts of things that happen on Christmas Eve itself. This is on Thursday, of course. You've got your Bethlehem manger square processions to the Nativity Grotto. Midnight Mass follows. There's one in Nazareth, of course, but they're happening all around the world. Palestinian officials and pilgrims attend Mass at the Nativity Church, led by the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Fouad Twal, for example. And, St Peter's in Rome, there's events.
And they make
the
radish out of all of those things?
They may feature.
Am I getting confused?
They might be. Yeah. They're inspired by any people from all different
walks
denominations.
Of life.
Well, I think we're going to give you one final one.
What about on Christmas Day? Yeah. You know, of course, there's things in this country. You've got the Queen's speech and all this sort of thing. But I like all of those nutters who go out and do things like, you know, break the ice and swim in the sea and in the serpentine and all this kind of thing. Those Christmas swims happen all up and down this country.
Surfy Grove.
Similar.
She loves that.
Does she take the Christmas Day plunge?
She likes to go in the coldest water you can imagine.
It's just too... Yeah. That's just too brisk.
I know. It's rough. Anyway...
And yeah, there's various things like that going on all around. So just have your fill.
That was great. You fizzled a bit on the last no. And anyway, there's
all things going on. It was too chilly.
Yeah, chilly.
What's your favourite thing out of all those things?
Probably some radish carving. I'm going to give it a bash this year. Radish carving.
It's a whip round. Tom Edwards, thank you so much for a fantastic year of News Lookaheads, by the way.
And happy birthday, happy Merry Christmas to you both, and Happy New Year to one and all.
Happy Christmas to you and the little one.
Oh, yeah, little Alfred.
Oh, yeah.
First Christmas. Ho-ho!
So it's nearly Christmas, and as many of you fill your cupboards with goodies for the upcoming week of festivities, there's one vital ingredient that must not be omitted: the booze. And to get yourself into the spirit, why not warm up with an aperitif, the taster tipple that serves as an alcoholic teaser, stimulating the appetite for what's shortly to come.
Alex Camerling is the founder of Cam & Sons, a business looking to put his English take on the aperitif firmly on the table. Having begun his working life as a sculptor, he soon found that his day or night job making cocktails was where another of his talents came to the fore. He's since written books on the subject, and Cam & Sons is the result of a love of experimenting with ingredients. Alex's creation has subtle bitter notes, infusing 41 botanicals, including fresh grapefruit peel, ginseng and juniper, distilled with manuka honey, worm and gentian, and he joins us now to define those terms and many others. Alex, welcome to the program.
Very nice to be here. Thank you very much.
While we were stuttering our way through the queue, there, you've made for us, basically, out of a small kind of smart-looking suitcase, the kind that an 80s businessman would have taken on Concord. Out of that, you have produced an amazing mini bar with all sorts of stuff. And front and foremost are two Cam & Sons bottles, which look not unlike medicine bottles. There's quite a nice sort of aesthetic sense to everything as well, isn't there?
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, coming from an art background, I wanted everything to look and feel as good as it tasted. So, yeah, actually the starting point was I wanted to make something that was healthier. An oxymoron,
really?
So, you might say, healthy booze, but I've been drinking alcohol as medicine for thousands of years. We drink it socially as medicine now, but of course, you know, if we get started on this route, we could be talking for hours, but the starting point was I wanted to make something that was healthier, so I included healthier ingredients, so ginseng, goji berries, manuka honey, echinacea, things like that.
Now, before we dive into any drinks, tell us a little bit about the origination of your company and exactly what is an aperitif as well. Maybe you could just set the scene for us.
Like you don't know, Andrew.
Well, just to put it out there. So an aperitif is a stimulating alcoholic drink which is served before eating to open the palate.
And this is the world that you wanted to crack into with something a little bit healthier and something a bit more British? Or what?
Exactly. Well, the starting point was I was inspired by those Italian aperitifs. Absolutely love Campari, Negronis and Aperol Spritz, all those things. But I wanted to make an English type aperitif. So I took the inspiration from gin. So it's basically distilled like a gin, but there's just way more ingredients in there. And I've got this bittersweet flavour to it, which kind of sets it apart from a gin.
Now, also while we're talking, you have a fantastically glamorous assistant that's brought in some hot drinks into the studio.
A hot assistant bringing hot drinks.
Hey! Talk us through this one. Maybe we should go for this one first. I don't know.
Where would you like to begin?
Let's start with the aperitif. What I've done is I've kind of themed this around Christmas. So we've got a pre-dinner drink. So based on the Aperol Spritz, this is a kind of a nice light. It's slightly summery, but actually it's one of those drinks which as soon as you kind of drink it, you'll enjoy it, and actually you won't mind that it's a bit chillier outside. I'll do two of these.
And I like the fact that you brought a proper metal.
Isn't that beautiful?
Ice bucket.
Yeah, I mean that is beautiful. Where's the ice bucket from as well?
We should. I have no idea.
This is a beautiful kind of.
Tell me, Alex. When we go to bars now, that you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was this kind of trend moving to like Prohibition era style drinks, to smaller servings, to being a little bit more old fashioned, and cocktails that had a bit of a story to tell. Is this the kind of world that it feels that your drinks are perfectly matched up? When I look at the bottles, they have these amazing little labels that kind of say exactly what batch they were made in, what number the bottle is. Do you have to be, you know, part of that world to kind of get your drink into bars and to understand exactly what's going on?
If we talk about the high-end bars, I mean, I think there is a move in some parts of the industry towards lower ABV and lighter styles of drinks, but there's also a move into kind of reducing the juice and the fruit and things in them, and you can actually taste the alcohol. You know, I think when I started bartending in sort of, you know, late 80s, early 90s, it was about hiding the taste of the alcohol, whereas now the appreciation has built up so much, it's about bringing that to the fore.
And the quality of the alcohol is better. You've got
absolutely different stuff, it's about kind of celebrating the taste. And actually, you know, alcohol's got a fantastic taste. It's you know, it's something to be, you know, inspired.
So
by
just tell our listeners what you're adding. So you've added a slice of cucumber. We're just looking at eyeing those drinks very ambitiously. But
I was going to start talking about my mouth watering.
I've mixed this much up prior to the show.
What's in here?
So what we've got is we've got Cameron Sons, we've got elderflower cordial, we've got sparkling wine, English sparkling wine, and we've got soda water.
And then you have added some fruit.
I put a slice of cucumber just to freshen it and a squeeze of grapefruit.
Wow, this looks delicious. Cheers, Andrew.
Cheers, Robbie. Cheers. Happy Christmas.
So this is called a Brit Spritz.
A Brit. Very good.
English sparkling wine, English elderflower.
God, that's good. That's English delicious.
Spritz. Amazing.
That's got an amazing sort of floweriness, but a real kind of alcoholic
You've got the bitterness, you've got the sweetness, you've got the dryness from the wine, you've got the freshness from the fruit. It all just kind of works. And
at the start of the show, we introduced you as somebody who had started off his life as a sculptor and moved into this world.
Like an Elton John lyric.
If I was a sculptor.
But then again, no. Oh, no. Now I make cocktails. No. It's fine.
But how did that journey go from chipping rock to chipping Norton, I was going to say, next to chipping ice.
Like the chipping rock set.
Well, the journey went in that I was just working in a bar to pay my studio rent. And I fell into bar work, and just because it was fun, it was sociable, I really enjoyed the people that I was with, other artists and musicians and actors and things. So it was a great crowd. And I put my creativity into making cocktails. I won a few competitions. I went on to create, I was getting paid to create drinks for brands. There was a huge renaissance of interest in the industry. I mean, at the time there was 5 or 6 really good bars, and I was working in one of those. I didn't realize that at the time. And there more and more bars grew, more interest and more articles, and I then went on to write a book and all the rest of it. So just one thing leads to another.
Now you're making a second drink here. Yeah. You should tell us what's going on.
Absolutely. So look, what I'm doing here is this is very easy. This is a 2-ingredient cocktail, so kind of, and referencing the earlier comments.
We're going down in the number of ingredients. I like this.
Yeah, we're getting stronger. So where you've got the aperitif there, this is very much more on the digestive style, and this is using my new addition, which is the Isla cask, which is a stronger version that's been resting in an Isla whiskey barrel. So this is just a heavy, bitter aperitif called Punta Mez, which is one of my favourites, and it's just mixed with
that is
amazing.
And that's just a 50 ml of Cameron Sons cask.
And this is a different one of your premixes.
Yeah, so it's 43% as opposed to 33%.
And you can really taste the scotchiness.
Yeah, it's nice, kind of, you know, nice and smooth, slightly peated, a little bit of wood, absolutely delicious. It's a limited edition, this one.
Is quite amazingly delicious.
How much of your life and work is about drinks in bars and selling directly to the public? Is there a kind of an off-sale kind of world that you're involved in as well?
Yes, I mean, we sell in Selfridges, Hobby Nicks, those kind of places, Fortnum's, whatever. But what I do is I sell to the distributor sells to those supermarkets. What I do on a day-to-day basis is I support those accounts, maybe with sampling or trainings, but I do more on the on-trade. So it's visiting bars and restaurants and hotels and talking about the aperitif culture, talking about the moment, and so that people can understand where Cameron Sons fits into that marketplace.
Is it easy to get in there in the first place? I mean, obviously you've got a network now, but in the early days?
It was fairly easy for me to get those meetings to open the doors.
I was just trying to give Andrew a break, because presumably that's very much part of it. So it's a person-to-person industry.
Absolutely. You know, there's more and more brands coming onto the market, and it's a very small space and it's very competitive. And if you're not on the cocktail list, then you tend to just sit on the back bar and it sells quite slowly. So, you know, the goal is to get onto the cocktail list and to make sure that people are talking about it and tweeting about it. So we do lots of other activities. So I've got a little pop-up bar in Street Feast. I had one in Dalston Yard, and now I've got one in Hawker House, which is their new venue.
And tell me, where is it actually made then?
It's made in Clapham.
Made in Clapham in sunny South London.
Yeah, invented in my kitchen in North London, now made in South London.
And do you think there's an opportunity, you know, all of these great aperitifs have been travelling for, you know, across borders for many years, but is there a chance for you to nudge into an Italian bar, do you think, or into a French bar?
I've not gone to Italy yet. We're selling in France.
We're talking Christmas. So the drink that we've just had, this is...
Brilliant after dinner.
Pretty after.
So the Brits
so
have
that. So I finished my aperitif, Andrew, because I wanted to do it in order.
Yeah, but
so I've had a taste of my digestivo, but you like that one, don't you, more?
This is my favourite.
You don't know whether you're on foot or on horseback. You're between the two.
Oh, this is my favourite.
So he's asking, so it's Christmas?
No, but I was going to say, and then there's a third.
Well, the third one is... Well, the third one.
Professional interviewing, is it? It's not professional.
What, just drinking that. Three at once?
Yeah. That's good. No, I'm only joking.
What's the third option?
The third one is a warm one. So it's when you've come back, you've had your Christmas dinner, or this is even a Boxing Day drink. You've been for a long walk, you're chilly, you come back. That's the drink to have. It's very simple, slightly kind of American theme. We've got bourbon, cranberry juice, and Camazons, and it's just warmed through with a little bit of lemon peel.
And for you... legitimately on Christmas Day, these are the three drinks that you would be trying to get your parents
if I could get my parents to even drink, then these are the drinks that they would be having. I come from a long line of teetotalers.
You should come to my house.
But although saying that, my there's always a bottle of this in the house, and they are drinking more regularly than they have ever done, which I'm not sure is a good thing, but
it is, because it's very healthy stuff. That's what you said at the beginning. Come on, it's good.
But it's interesting, that journey for somebody who... Later on the show, we're going to be speaking to a woman who designs cookbooks, but who has gone on to run her own food company and be on both sides of the fence. And it's interesting, you have that same journey. You're somebody who knows how a bar works, you know how to make actually a cocktail, and you also make the raw ingredients yourself. You must be a rare person, because I imagine there's some of those conversations when you're selling drinks and you go into a bar and you have a slightly stuck-up cocktail maker who doesn't want to be told what to do. You arrive, and you must be able to kind of talk to them on their own level for the first time.
Well, the way I kind of seem to do it is...
Get them in a headlock.
Get them in a headlock, yeah. if I go in and I try to just talk about the whole category, I think if you're a brand and you come in and you just talk about yourself, you get no appreciation for it at all.
I guess it's good to say, these guys are doing this, this is great.
Yeah, absolutely. If you say, I absolutely love these things, these are classic brands, these are fantastic, this is how they're made, and you you show that you're passionate about the industry, then they're like, okay, right, this guy's not just here to sell his product, he's here to talk about other stuff as well. Then you get the airtime, and then you kind of, it's about building relationships, and you have to do it slowly, and it's not a kind of walk in the door, and you immediately got a listing, and sell tons of the stuff. It just takes time to... build that rapport.
And we're looking at these a couple of the beautiful Cam and Sons bottles that you brought in today, Alex, and I don't want to sort of make your operations seem small fry for a second, but take us back to your kitchen table in North London. What did that look like, and how on earth do you go about making a spirit, an aperitif from scratch? Is it kind of lots of herbs and powders and bottles on the table? Does it look like kind of Frankenstein?
Kind of was I started by sort of trying to find as many ingredients I could find in gins, in chartreuse, Benedictine, aperitifs, bitters, all of the natural ingredients that have been used before. And I had leaves, herbs, spices, roots, flowers, nuts, citrus, and I just infused all of them into alcohol. So I started, just made little jars of alcohol. I made a tincture, essentially, from single botanicals. Most of them dried, some of them fresh. And then you leave them in there for between 2 days to 2 months, depending on what they are. And I filtered them all and then went through each one sort of methodically and made notes, tasty notes on each one. So, sweet, bitter, dry, floral, nutty, woody, earthy, etc. And then started to blend each one to try and get a recipe which one tasted good, was versatile, but also was a little bit better for you. But, it sounds quite easy, but that took 5 years.
Yeah,
it wasn't an easy.
Basically, it's like drinking. It's kind of drinking a tube of Savlon. Steal that for the advertising campaign.
We're not able to stand up for the next interview.
It's made me quite hot, but I like it. I tell you what, thank you so much for coming in. It's fascinating stuff. The bottles, it was so beautiful. Cam and Sons, right? They're amazing. It's a great brand.
Can we direct people to a website or anywhere?
You can go to camandsons.com and then all the...
That's K-A-M-M, by the way.
K-A-M-M.
People will end up buying a crankshaft for their car.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Time for some music now. We've been knocking back a tipple or two on this Christmas edition of The Weekly, so here's an aptly themed band who released one of the best albums of 2015. It's London's The Drink with Like a River.
That was The Drink with Like a River. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week. With me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Snowy escapes in the mountains are a favourite at this time of year. Indeed, you'll often find the Monocle 24 team in locations such as St Moritz. It's an observation not lost on Irish author and poet Padraig Rooney, who's been looking at the attraction of the Swiss Alps as an escape for some of the world's most celebrated writers seeking to get away from the city and explore both their thoughts and the surrounding landscape. Those writers range from Byron and Mary Shelley to Arthur Conan Doyle and Ernest Hemingway.
The result is his new book, The Gilded Chalet, off-piste in literary Switzerland, and good old Tom Edwards sat down and had a chat with him earlier.
Let's start with, I guess, the premise of the Gilded Chalet, your new book. It's about, in loose terms, I guess, about authors and flocking to Switzerland, why it's always happened, the sort of literary history of this. And you, I guess, should be able to explain as well as anyone what it is about Switzerland that works for writers, being as you are a resident there yourself. Why, first of all, what is it about Switzerland? Why this history, and why did you become a part of that same movement?
I guess I was looking at the books that are already available about Switzerland in shops, and there didn't seem to me to be that much about this incredible wealth of people who, some of whom lived in Switzerland, some just popped in, some wrote major works there, others had noble or ignoble reasons for going there throughout history. And so when I began to investigate it, I began to see that it fulfilled a kind of function in the middle of Europe as a place where people would go to escape wars, for example, or to escape Puritanism in the north or in the north of Europe, or bad marriages, or simply just passing through on their way south to Italy. So I think probably Byron, Shelley, and Mary Shelley, that trio at the beginning of the 19th century, they kick-started that approach to Switzerland as a place where you could run away to.
Well, yeah, and there's this idea that sort of reoccurs both in the book and, I guess, through this literary history about this Switzerland as this sort of utopia. H.G. Wells, of course, we're talking about utopia, which is one of the sort of chapters in the book. Where does that come from? Is it about, you know, the clean alpine air almost? Is there something about a purity of existence there that's always lent itself to that? Or is it something a bit more complex than that?
I think it's probably got something to do with the Industrial Revolution in Britain, when the air was less clean than it is now, and people wanted to go somewhere, partly for their health, but also because Switzerland represented a kind of paradise to them. The superb scenery, the clean mountain air, and at a time of tuberculosis as well in 19th century Europe, in 19th century urban environments, Switzerland had that in spades, both landscape and air. So one of the chapters I really enjoyed writing was looking at the various people who popped in and out of Davos, for example, and turned it into a spa town, partly because of tuberculosis, but also the English group who lived there was spearheaded by Simmons, who was a kind of arty, gay writer of the 19th century, and he attracted other people, and before you know it, it became a kind of little mini literary salon.
Yeah, a salon. It's interesting you make that point about the salon, because all through the book there are various sorts of meetings of minds, I guess, or just meetings of circumstance almost. One of my favourites is in the book a meeting of minds. You have Chaplin, you've got Graham Greene, and you have James Mason, who's interestingly their careers in so many ways cross over, the literary parts of their lives cross over.
Yeah.
Did you have a favourite one of these little salons, these accidental meetings? That was probably one of mine. What were your favourites?
I like the way Nabokov came into that, because he was living at Montreux down the road from Chaplin and James Mason, and how it was almost a little glamour world of Hollywood meets high literature, and which I think Nabokov enjoyed. He had a long interest in cinema and in going right back to silent movies. And so I think he rather enjoyed the glam aspect of parts of Switzerland, even though he was quite retiring. I also enjoyed Patricia Highsmith's take on the country. She was
there's some lovely detail as well.
She was grumpy. Yeah. She came to Switzerland late in her career, as did Chaplin and James Mason. And so it tends, that area around the lake and in Ticino, the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland, tends to be places where people retire to. And my favorite story about Patricia Highsmith is the way she smuggled snails into France. She collected snails, and she used to secrete them down her embonpoint to get them across the channel, because technically you're not allowed to import snails to France, because France likes to think of itself as the snail capital of the world, you know. So I just like the idea of this mistress of murders sneaking snails onto the continent.
Some interesting facets to her sort of general dietary and lifestyle in the book, of course. A lot of these characters, it seems, you know, this idea of maybe seeking refuge, and this speaks, as you say, to what we've already talked about with the clean air and this sense of the sense of getting away from things. But Switzerland as a refuge, obviously historically, very obviously in some cases. But that's not the whole story. You know, a lot of people describe it, and some of you chart, I'm probably going to butcher again another name here, but Duren Matt and his, you know, The Scourge of Switzerland, and his critiques, if you like, of the country, far from being a refuge, you know, describing it, seeing it, feeling it as a prison almost. Do you think that's an interesting counterpoint? On the one hand, this place of great freedom, and on the other, something quite restrictive. I guess that's the theme that kind of crops up in the book a few times.
Yes, Duren Matt and Frisch and a range of other writers were looking at Switzerland after the war, when it could think of itself proudly as having survived the war and as a neutral country, but also think of itself as somewhat ignoble, because it had facilitated both sides, and there were lots and lots of political and financial compromises involved in that. And it took a long time for that to come out into the public space in Switzerland. People knew about it, but knew about assets and the various banking revelations that occurred in the late 20th century, and to some extent lately the issue of stolen art and Nazi art has come back into the news again. It seems to be a perennial subject. So Duren Matt looked at that, and Swiss writers of the post-war period tended to like to scratch around that kind of material and stir up if you can stir up a can of worms. I'm not quite sure if you can.
I think you can. I think you can. And what about in modern Switzerland and looking to the future? Do you think that we'll see, you know, I don't know, a strand of this literary history continuing, or do you think things have changed? I mean, you're still living and working there now. Do you think it's different, or can you identify things day to day that still have the hallmarks of some of these trends that we've been talking about?
It's certainly more expensive than it was during previous wars and previous crises when people could afford to go there. So it's not, as I say in the book at one point, it's not Bohemian Central by any means. And so it's difficult to make a case for Switzerland as being the new Berlin or the new Barcelona, or as being somehow edgy in that way. I think Switzerland as a country tends to brand much more. It's what it's got to offer. So if you look at the branding of James Bond, for example, turning it into a kind of global money spinner, Switzerland tends to do that sometimes with its history. It's selling air, it's selling chocolate, it's selling freedom. It's, to some extent, proud of its neutral history. But whether it's a creative place or not for contemporary Swiss writers, I don't know. A lot of them seem to run a mile. It can be a confining place. It's a small country, small population. It's even smaller still because a lot of activity goes on at cantonal level or even regional level. So a lot of the writers I spoke to Peter Stamm and Daniel Deroulet and a number of other writers about their notion of Swissness, and they would be fairly hesitant at identifying themselves with Switzerland as a whole. They're much more interested in identifying with the French language, say, or German-speaking culture, or just writing what they want to write.
Well, I was going to ask you about that idea of Swissness, actually, particularly in literary terms. I mean, is there such a thing? I mean, I know, again, we sort of dip in and out of this idea in the book, but, I mean, can you define something like that? What it is to be, you know, Swiss in character, whether it's writing or whether it's, yeah, part of the national psyche almost? Is it too difficult to define?
I think it's easier to define the national psyche than, say, what a particular writer might pick up as a subject matter. Mm. The national psyche is very much an island in the center of Europe trying to negotiate between powers around it. And lately that has meant a kind of two-step dance with the EU. And so when borders close in the Schengen district, for example, we might wonder how Switzerland's going to tackle that situation. Because I live in Basel, which is the northwest corner of Switzerland, and I shop in Germany and in France, and it's a 20-minute car ride away to cross the border. If that suddenly became closed and confined as it was 20, 30 years ago, that would cause quite a lot of financial damage, I think, to Switzerland. Because the cross-border idea, the idea that Switzerland needs to make connections with France and Germany and Italy and Austria on its borders, is part of the appeal of the country.
Porrig, a couple of the, so in fact, some of the writers we've already mentioned in our discussion, at several points in the book you sort of say, you know, writing what turned out to be very prescient comments, or this idea that people who have been writing, you know, sometimes over, you know, maybe as much as a century ago, managed to somehow describe modern Switzerland fairly in quite an apposite way. Why do you think that happens? Is it just because it's great writers, and often great writers have great insights? Mm-hmm. Or, I don't know, is Switzerland, has it been predictable in some ways? Why do you think so many people managed, or some of the writers that you focus in on, managed to sort of divine some of these characteristics so effectively? Why do you think that happened?
Mm-hmm. Many of them are describing landscapes and scenery, and that, of course, hasn't changed much. Switzerland is very good at preserving its attributes, and so, but also it's a slow place to change. Change occurs slowly and methodically in Switzerland with great consensus. So when I first arrived in Switzerland, there were no or very few anti-smoking laws, for example. They've only come in after such decisions had been made elsewhere in Europe. So Switzerland is sometimes led to the table with that kind of movement because it moves through consensus and at cantonal level. So, yeah, it's John le Carré talks about the timelessness of Switzerland, and I think that's true. It has a kind of timeless, pristine quality, which is attractive to me and has been attractive to all of the writers in my book. But sometimes young people, I do wonder whether they would have the experience to appreciate that aspect of timelessness.
Mm. Porrig, just finally then, you know, forgive the pun, but where's the next chapter, if you like, in the sort of literary history of the country written? Do you think it might be written by, you know, Swiss writers who leave and write from without? Will it still be an attractive place for writers from the US, from the United Kingdom, from Ireland to continue to go? Where do you think the next, if you like, chapter in the literary story of Switzerland, where might that be written?
I'd need to think about that one.
I'd like to give you a nice easy question at the end.
I'm not so much au fait about what foreign writers are writing about Switzerland now, apart from my own book. But certainly a writer who has crossed over in recent years is Peter Stamm, because he's got a wonderful translator in Michael Hoffman, and his books are doing well in the English-speaking world. So as a small country, writers are looking to break open into the larger air and the larger market of English publishing, and perhaps French publishing as well. But certainly Peter Stamm is a writer that I would look at.
That was Monocle's Tom Edwards talking to author and poet Padraig Rooney about The Gilded Chalet, off-piste in literary Switzerland. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
Designer Kaz Hildebrand is known for her work across many industries. She, the talent behind London design agency Here. But perhaps some of the most eye-catching designs are going to end up in a few of your Christmas stockings and wrapped up under trees this week. Cookbooks. Kaz has worked on titles from some of the world's cooking greats, ranging from Yotam Ottolenghi to Nojella Lawson. She was also the co-author and designer of one of the most original food books of recent years, The Geometry of Pasta, which took a clinical designer's eye to the many shapes and sizes of pasta we enjoy, as well as providing some mouth-watering recipes too.
And she is here now to tell us about her work and to talk us through a stack of both her own and others' cookbooks. Thanks to our friends at Dawn Books here in Marylebone. Kaz, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Now, we should reveal one or two things. First of all, I met you at the weekend because you were running a stand here at the Monocle Fair, because the world of geometry of pasta, you didn't just do the cookbook, but this is kind of your company as well. Just, can you just, before we dive into the cookbooks, just tell us so we know everything about you?
I'll try. Not much to say, but the Geometry of Pasta, the book, somehow has led us to becoming producers of pasta and sauces too. So we now have our own range of pasta, which we were very happily selling here to many enthusiastic purchasers all over the weekend for the Christmas fair.
And the Geometry of Pasta is literally about that, isn't it? It's about that you've kind of become intrigued about the very shapes and designs that you can do with pasta.
Well, we understood something very fundamental, which is that Italians would never serve certain shapes of pasta with certain sauces, which to the rest of us Philistines seemed very strange. So in trying to understand what the rationale was for putting certain shapes with certain sauces, we started to try and unpack what the secrets were, which I think we've done reasonably comprehensively now. And in doing that, obviously, you know, one thing led to another, and we started talking to fantastic pasta makers and sauce makers, and we now inhabit this pasta world.
So you're one of those rare beasts that kind of straddles, you know, designing the cookbooks, designing the recipes, making the actual food and the ingredients that goes into them as well. Yeah. You must be one of the few people who does that. Rob?
And I wanted to ask you, I mean, we've got some of the books you've designed on the table here, all of them sort of such handsome publications, and all quite different, although presumably all sort of strung together by one thing, which is good design, he says with a wink. But presumably this is the thing. Do people come to you and kind of need help, or do cooks come to you with a very definite idea of how to get their personality across and their kind of aesthetic across?
I think it's a bit of a mixture. Some people are very clear, yeah, and very categorical about what they do and don't like. And other people simply do what they do and they need help to bring what they do to life in a form that other people can get sort of make sense of and get access to. And actually what we're doing really, it's a kind of peculiar thing to say, but in a way I think we just see ourselves as sort of midwives really and help them give birth to their books. So the books really need to reflect them, not us. It's not the Here Design Show.
No, indeed.
It's really about what they're trying to say.
But do you sort of have to edit their, do you have to slightly edit their desires? I mean, do people overwrite or underwrite recipes? Do people want a recipe that only, for example, has five stages and you say, do you know what? This is going to look better on the page if it's got 10 steps or the other way around.
We really try to respect the recipes. I mean, yeah, most people are really brilliant at what they do in terms of creating recipes, but getting them achievable by ordinary people in ordinary kitchens is obviously quite a big factor if you're a restaurant cook or chef, should I say. Actually, the main thing really is for us to try and share the fantastic, delicious recipes that people invent and make them appealing and accessible to the rest of us, because they're so wonderful and, you know, we need to convey that.
Kaz, tell me, the book, one of the books we have that you worked on here is the Ottolenghi cookbook for the restaurant Nopi. Mm. Now, it's got a really kind of beautiful gold tinge to the edge of the pages, really amazing, calm, full-page pictures, a really beautiful, stylized, almost 30s font. When you begin to put a book together like this, how much are you getting an influence over photography, over the way that it's written? What's your nexus in kind of mixing all these ingredients together?
Well, I think in a sense, what we try to do is, if there is some sort of a brand that exists, and as it happened, this was a brand that we sort of designed for the restaurant, so obviously it was one that we knew inside out. So that helps. But also, there needs to be some sort of a shared vision. What is the purpose of this book? Why does the world need another cookbook? Because arguably it doesn't. What are we trying to say, and how are we going to say it? So obviously the photography is critical, If the food doesn't make you want to eat it that you see in photographs, there's no point in having it there. And obviously recipes have to be accessible. People have got to be able to read them. So you can't make the type too small or too over-designed so that it's inaccessible.
And I imagine a practical thing that most people have it kind of open. They want everything on a spread. They don't want to be turning back and forth pages. They're going to have sticky hands. All those things must oddly come into play, how it's going to be used as well.
It is a very pragmatic thing, and it is a challenge sometimes to make things look good that are very complicated. And the rule of thumb is if we can't make sense of it, there's no reason that anyone else should manage either. So we try and use ourselves as guinea pigs, if you like.
And in the collection of books that we've got here, in fact, they're very beautiful. And this Nopi one is, as Andrew says, there's a bit of a deco, kind of an updated deco vibe to it. But they do seem very practical, and the photography seems quite timeless, actually, because that's the thing. I mean, you know, I love some of my mum's got, I don't know, 500 cookbooks. I love looking at the late 60s and 70s one, the Robert Carrier one with the sort of bleached colour photography, the sort of Hamlin all colour cookbook, all these kind of wonderful things. But then there was a moment in the 90s when they became quite, I suppose, the River Cafe. It was very practical, but it was very modern with a capital M. It's a different thing. How do you ensure that sort of timelessness? Because there's some of the sort of kinfolk style photography which might look quite dated in a couple of years' time, sort of super kind of dyed colours and darkness. How do you make sure that you're up to trend without being on trend so much?
Well, actually, that's exactly what we try and do, make a classic. And actually, we have to ask ourselves, what will this look like in 10 years' time? Will it make our toes curl with embarrassment, or will it still look okay? And I think actually that's the brief, that if it's too of the moment, it won't last, it won't stand the test of time. And I don't know if then it's just helpful not to be very fashionable in a way, and just really try to respond to the brief for itself rather than trying to peg it to some current trend. And I think if something is itself, then that's the thing that people judge rather than thinking, oh my God, that looks so, you know, 90s or whatever.
Because they kind of, you love it for that, but then it becomes strangely less useful somehow because of that.
It stops you. It can really inhibit you, and you think, oh, God, I mean, who would eat that now? I'm sure your Robert Carrier books, you know, you look at those now and they're kind of charming.
Yeah.
But whether you immediately go turn to those recipes, I don't
know. They seem like historical, you know, they seem historical rather than practical still. Perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah.
Too many vol-au-vents.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But that is the amazing thing. You know, when my parents passed away, one of the things I did take from the house in the end were the cookbooks that we had grown up with. And even now, I find it quite an emotional thing that when you pull open the pages, you can still see the stains of meals made many years ago. And unlike most hardback books, they are to be, you know, they look better with a bit of kind of flour dust on them and the odd kind of buttery fingerprint here and there. It's interesting because these books will be used and around for a very long time if you do the job right. Have you enjoyed seeing that process as a designer, seeing something that has that journey?
I love going into, you know, other people's houses and seeing the beaten up, battered, spattered range of cookbooks and things that, you know, have a use, have a purpose. It's great to design a book, but if it sits there unopened, in a way we fail. And that's the saddest thing. So something that's been abused and used is a cheer, actually. You send up a cheer of delight. Yes.
And just to me also, you know, for someone who's, you know, I think if you compared mine and Rob's cooking skills, Rob is actually quite a dab hand, whereas I'm not.
I think Andrew is.
So I'm always, you know, when I get a cookbook, I kind of need to see a picture. And I know lots of people, really real cooks, are, oh, so much photography. Why all this photography? I know exactly what I'm doing. Is that, again, a balancing act of how visual you make it? Because in a way, it becomes the risk of it becoming a coffee table book. But the reality is that I would not know what it was meant to look like on the plate without that image.
I mean, in a way, it's a slightly sad function of our expectation that we've all got to cook like chefs. So we all feel everything's got to look so perfect. On the other hand, there are so many recipes from so many parts of the world with ingredients we've never heard of, there is some benefit to having an idea of the sort of thing you're aspiring to do. And there's no doubt that it seduces you into making recipes. You think, oh my God, that looks so delicious, I'm going to make it. Whereas having the time to sit by the fire and read Elizabeth David's wonderful prose and then imagine what it's going to look like is a different, very different sort of thing to do.
Where do you stand on hands
having hands, you know, when you the chef's hands mixing the whatever it might be, marinating the tagliata.
Many hands make light.
You like that? You like to see a hand in a picture?
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Now, you were quite generous. You brought along a very large cookbook, which we've I know we've discussed on Marcus Hippie's program, The Menu. It's the Nordic cookbook, which. It's a thumping thing. We were in Reykjavik recently, and even there, coming through Reykjavik Airport, I saw piles of these books. It's been a bit of a hit. It's the Magnus Nilsson book. Tell me why you brought this in as a particular example of something you like and admire.
I think the idea of a kind of compendium that really tries to look at a whole culture and a whole sort of system of cooking gives you such a fabulous overview. And then you can begin to edit what you like. But it's something I know very little about Nordic cooking. So how great to have it all encapsulated here. And he goes into a lot of detail about subtle differences and things that make a point of difference from location or area, or whatever.
And I think one of the other wonderful things about it is that its sense of place is very good. You know, the photography of kind of windswept fjords, of grazing sheep, of kind of slightly gnarled hands. There is a kind of an attempt to move away from just the kitchen, just the kind of the hotel kind of perfection, as you spoke about earlier.
I think it takes you to a place. And the idea of cookbooks, as well as for cooking, using recipes, is to be transported. And this is a perfect example of that.
And tell me, with someone like Nigella Lawson, who you've worked with, and again, a really beautiful book you've produced for her, when somebody is a TV celebrity, a very successful cook, a very good cook, how much do you get to do your bit to be, you know, your creative self, to do your kind of cooking? And how much are you kind of like, okay, this is a little bit more of a complicated relationship? Not complicated, but the dynamic is a bit more different here. There's an expectation of what I need because this is a commercial operation.
To be honest, actually, it's kind of the same as any other book. We worked together for a long time on all of Nigella's cookbooks, and she cooks all the food herself. Some of it comes out beautifully, some of it we redo. We sort of stumble along like we would on any other book. Obviously, there are pressures in the sense that publishers want Nigella to be on the front of the cover, and you know, that's
quite a lot
of thing.
Fewer pictures of her in that book. I mean, yeah. The cover picture looks great, she looks great, but do you know what I mean? There was it's not like the TV show as well, because that's something that you could do a restaurant volume, then you have an element of reflecting the restaurant. And I suppose if it's a TV chef, as Andrew was saying, then you've got that expectation as well.
Actually, it comes
it's
back
a,
to your
juggle, isn't it?
Yeah, your point earlier, which is that this is a really great book that should stay around for a long time. Television is more transient. And I think a book is a sort of object, a thing that stays with you. So it needs to stand that test of time, like we were talking about earlier. And I think that there is such a lot in there. It's not really about a personality in that sense. It's about a voice and an approach and an idea about food. And Nigella has a particular idea. And it's really just trying to ensure that people enjoy that and explore much more than just the things they saw on the show.
Kaz, before we let you escape, we should be quizzing you a little bit about your own personal Christmas. So is it pasta on Christmas Day?
Absolutely not. Maybe it's the one day of the year you have a rest.
You're properly traditional? There's something happening, is there? Are you not the cook?
No, I think just somehow traditional Christmases seem truly to belong to another time and place. It's always a bit of a combination, isn't it, of some of those things. The best thing about the turkey is the turkey sandwiches on Boxing Day, let's face it.
Brilliant. Well, Kaz Hildebrand, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Rob, I think that's all for the Monocle Weekly in 2015. We've been very good because we were left a few drinks.
I hope the microphone didn't pick up that. I was just finishing the last of Alex's cocktails.
Slowly finish off. Kaz was a great guest, and it was so nice to speak to her about kind of the book design. But
I think we held it together after Alex came on.
Yeah,
I think we held it together pretty well.
I think we're good for Kaz, and then Kaz left, and then we've paused for 2 seconds, and we've knocked back the rest of the drinks that were left. And I think we're ready to go party.
I think we're ready to rock and roll. I think we're ready for Christmas, aren't you, Andrew?
I'm so ready for Christmas Eve. I cannot wait for Christmas Eve and gay abandon.
Christmas Eve and Gay Abandon, of course.
They're doing a show later on.
I forgot that these are two drag queens.
Should we thank all of our...
Should we thank our pals behind the glass? Today's show is produced by Tom Hall.
Also known as Tammy Hall.
And our studio manager is the Carbonator. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time next week when we'll be looking back at the last 12 months, a best of show. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Merry Christmas.